And now, ladies and gentlemen, let us open our ears and most of all our hearts so that we can hear and feel every bit of our warm-up speaker's experience, strength, and hope. And help me welcome to the stage, Pete L. from Lemoore. Yeah.
Thank you. All right, my name is Pete. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. Yeah, I'm a little nervous, so let's see how this goes. I came to AA. I want to talk about step one. I know there's no real newcomers here on the first day, but it took me a long time to figure out that I was an alcoholic, because I had no idea what AA meant for alcoholic. I knew I was drunk, I knew I loved to be drunk, and I knew being drunk was killing me. But I did some research, I tried some controlled drinking, and I found out that I can't control and enjoy my drinking. Early on in my drinking career, I probably could have controlled it pretty good. I might have been able to stop. But I needed a spiritual experience in order to stop. And I got that through working the 12 steps.
That's right.
And let's see. I don't know. I think that I can't say enough about this program, because I really do believe it saved my life. And going back to step one, when I read the big book, finally, after that controlled drinking, it made sense in the doctor's opinion that I was addicted to alcohol, because I had no idea that you could get addicted to alcohol. I knew if you smoked meth every day, you'd probably get addicted, you know what I mean? But I had no idea that if you drank every day, that you could get a craving for it and an obsession that you can't stop without a spiritual experience. Okay, thank you. That's a little more comfortable. Yeah. I forgot where I was. Oh, smoking meth, all right. You guys like that one, huh? Shit. Anyways, yeah. Let's talk about huffing gas if you really want to talk about getting high. But yeah, my favorite buzz in the world was like two or three of those big Heinekens and some good Green Bud. And I grew up north by Humboldt County, way before pot was legal. And I had the good stuff. And I decided to make that my lifestyle. And that's what almost killed me. I would get a couple of those Heinekens in me, and I'd want a couple more. So I'd drive down to the store, no matter what condition I was in, because I'm Californian. If I have a car, I'm not going to walk. And I'm sure as hell not taking the bus. So I would drive to the store, and thank God I never got any DUIs, actually. I did wreck my dad's truck one time, and I was completely hammered. But I hid from the cops for like half an hour, and I turned myself in. And they couldn't prove that I drank within the time that I was hiding. So I got off scot-free. And which sucked, because my dad said, if I take this kid home, I'm going to kill him. And I think he meant it. I think my mom might have saved my life that time. But yeah. Now, I've done everything under the sun, pretty much, unless they designed something new in the last 11 years. And my favorite is alcohol. I'm blessed not to drink it today, honestly. And I believe that what keeps me from not drinking it is God. And I don't have to apologize for relying on His strength and not mine. It says that in the big book. And, you know, I might have thought of it as a way of weakness when I first came around, because all I heard was blah, 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 God. Blah, 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 Heineken. And that's all I heard. So I went home and I was like, all right, let's get some Heineken. This is fun still, right? I'm not dying yet. And you know what? I had 3 years sober, and my doctor suggested that I quit drinking because my liver was shot out. And I was like, well, doctor, I haven't had a drink in 3 years. And he's like, well, that's good. Your liver shot out. And so I think I might have stopped just in time. Who knows, you know? Some people aren't as blessed as we are. They're not in this room. I know that I have family members that deserve to be here, but they're not here. And, you know, I'm glad we take that moment of silence. I've only been coming around for 11 years, and I know at least 11 people that have died from this disease. It's a very serious illness, and it wants you dead. It's in the back of your mind doing push-ups and burpees and pull-ups and P90X and doing all sorts of stuff I don't do. Yeah, it wants to kill me. He's practicing. He's in his cell, though. So he's writing on the wall, day one, day two, day three. And he's pretty pissed. I call him Pete, though, you know. And I think that living a sober life is the best deal in town, really. Because I'm always looking for a deal. In Lemoore, it's a very small town. When I moved there, I thought, man, these people don't know how to party. I couldn't meet one drinker. I mean, I met a bunch of meth addicts, but I did not meet one drinker. And so I went to the bar, the saddest bar in town. Me and Robert used to drink there. We didn't know each other. There was like one pissed off rancher in the corner with a pitcher, drinking out of the pitcher. And every time I called the bartender by the wrong name, she would kick me out. And to this day, I cannot remember her name. I don't know, it's like Christy or Mandy or something, I don't know.
Tina.
Oh, Tina?
Yeah.
Is it Tina? See, I have no idea what her name is. That's probably why she kicked me out all the time. I tip her good, though. I learned that early on, you know. Leave a good tip and they'll serve you, but not her. She didn't care. Yeah, I black out in her bar all the time. I'm a blackout drinker, and I could look at a bottle of brandy and black out. My last really good drunk is on brandy. I got drunk about 4 in the afternoon. I blacked out around 5:30. I woke up the next morning. Luckily, I woke up in bed because I was naked. And everything in my crappy little apartment was broken. Everything. The TV, the ceiling fan, everything. The potted plant, the fish tank, my couch. And either I broke it or the guys I was partying with broke it. And I like to think that I broke it because I was so pissed off that I was drunk again. Because I always, in the back of my mind, wanted to be sober. Since I was 16, since I started drinking, really. I had no concept of total abstinence. And that, for me, today is my key for victory. You know, stay away from the first drink. That's the only way I could do it. And don't do drugs, honestly. Because I did both. I can't do either. So what keeps me away from that first drink, going back to my higher power, that's what it is. Honestly, it's God. The creator of the universe, I like to think of that. Because there's so many stars out there, and solar systems, and galaxies, and planets. And he made all that stuff. And then he came to Earth. I don't know if he came to Earth, but somehow he like touched me. And he got me sober. He pulled me out of the pit that I was in, dusted me off, and set me on my feet and gave me a design for living that really works. A program of action that's the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that big book that they gave away tonight will guide you through that with the help of a sponsor. And it's such a beautiful blessing. I think my 10 minutes are up. Thank you for listening to me. Have a good night.
And now, for the main speaker. Coming into the program at the age of 27, she holds a personal best of 10 years sober. I did the math and I wasn't sure if I was smart. God crossed our paths when I was in a recovery home where she visited by chance for our in-house meeting. She encouraged me and inspired me that there was hope for a helpless alcoholic like me. So please put your hands together for Kat.
Look at all you. I'm Kat. I'm an alcoholic. Would just greet me like that every day, we wouldn't have problems. I don't understand it. Is that, oops, I don't, it's very close to my mouth. I don't. Not in sobriety. Like I said, I'm Kat. I'm an alcoholic. I am honored to be an alcoholic. I am honored to be here with you today. You guys are my people. Thank you very much to Alyssa for asking me. Clearly a poor judge of character. Apologizing in advance. And thank you to Tookiepaw. You killed it tonight. This is amazing. The support is amazing. Everything's beautiful. The food was excellent. Thank you so much for having us. It's such an honor to be with you guys tonight. I went to the bathroom and prayed a couple times. I'm really concerned with being the best alcoholic in the room. I want to say, H and I, where'd she go? She was talking about hope. There you are. You were talking about hope. If you are new in the program, I'm going to tell you right now, hope is the promise of change. If you're sitting in this room and something's going on where you think it will not change or you think it's always going to be this way, I'm telling you right now, it's been my experience in this program that I am different. I am different from the person that walked into these rooms. I am different from the person that Alyssa met. I'm a different person today, so hold on. If you are not being guided by a sponsor in this program, I suggest you get guided and you remain sponsorable, because we can have a sponsor in. I'm getting off on a tangent. We'll talk about that when we get to the 12th step. But I want you to know, those people who are new, there's hope for change. And I want you to know that we don't feel the way you feel about you. That CNN banner that you think is going across your head that's displaying every bad thing you ever did, it's not. I've been there. I've done that. I want you to know that this program worked for me. I hope today that I can tell you what my experience, strength, and hope is with this program so that you can have the courage to say those words about yourself as well. Whew. So my sobriety date is February 9th of 2007. And that is not, I didn't pick that date. I woke up in a pool of my own. I was used to waking up in a pool of my own vomit. That day was no day in particular. I was in at my friend's house in Hanford, and I was tired of waking up in a pool of my own vomit. And she said, "Hey, I'm going to go to AA." And I was like, yes, that, what is that? Okay, I'll do that. You know, I am here because something out there loves me more than I love myself, or I'm capable of loving myself. So I'm going to backtrack a little bit. I needed a drink long before I had a drink. I can say that. I was restless, irritable, and discontent a long time before I had a drink. I was looking for something to change the way I felt a long time before I found alcohol. I remember being that kid who I would wake up in the morning and I would be upset that I woke up again and that this was my life. As a kid, I remember feeling separate. I remember feeling like invisible, unprotected. There's a story in the back of the book, and it says, I thought I was an alcoholic because of the things that happened to me as a child. But what I know is I'm an alcoholic because of the way I reacted to the things that happened to me as a child. That's my story. When I heard that story, I knew that something was going on in these rooms. And the power, other women being able to say that about themselves made me stay. There was something going on in the rooms if people could say that about themselves and not just be leveled by it. Not be just in a puddle on the ground over their story. I took my first drink when I was 14. And I'm going to tell you, I drank alcoholically that night, and that means that phenomenon of craving kicked off on that very first drink. I felt the sense of ease and comfort that the book talks about from that very first drink. I saw my friends drinking with impunity at that night when I had my first drink. And I drank my first drink, and I had come alive. You know, I had arrived, like Bill said. I had arrived. I was comfortable for the very first time. I was okay to be around other human beings for the very first time in my life. I was at a slumber party with a group of girls that I was absolutely sure did not have my story, you know, and I was really just faking it. I was really priding myself on being worse than I seemed, you know, and I just knew any second that they would find out who I really was and where I came from and what my story was. And I remember drinking that drink and tipping it and seeing the bottom, and then tipping another one and seeing the bottom, and tipping another one and seeing the bottom. And from my very first drink, I had consequences. And if you're an alcoholic like me, you know, I make bad decisions. I think I'm exempt. I do stupid stuff that I wouldn't normally do because I'm too, when I'm sober, I really care about how I look. You know, I want to look appropriate. I want to do everything right. But when I drink, it's been the only time I was ever able to release, ever able to just feel comfortable. So I had consequences that night, and not serious enough for me to think that I should stop drinking. Not serious enough for me to say, oh, maybe normal people don't act this way. But what I did that night, 14 years old, I put alcohol in an alcoholic body. I have a different reaction. I have an allergic reaction to alcohol. It makes me different from those other girls at that party that were like, what happened to her? Where did she go, first of all? I left that party. I went to my old house. It was abandoned, and I sat down in the backyard, and I was like, ooh, this probably shouldn't have ended this way, but meh. You know, they didn't have that reaction. You know, and I was able to get alcohol when I could get alcohol. You know, and I remember being 16 years old, driving around in Hanford, being bored, and being like, oh, let's get drunk. Yes. And I only put myself around people who were like me, who want to go away like me, who want that sense of ease and comfort like me. Whether they know it or not, I place myself around people like that. So we did. So we proceeded to do that. And I had every interaction I had from 16 on to 27 when I took my last drink, I was intoxicated. I did not know how to be a human being without having some alcohol between me and you. I had to have alcohol to feel comfortable in this world. I would, you know, I with my alcoholism, you know, I'm a perfectionist. I want to appear a certain way, you know. So I would go to work. I would get the job. I would get the good job and get the better job and get promoted or, you know, oh, we want you to work here. You know, people didn't tell me no very often, you know. Had the right clothes, continued to work, maintained employment, you know. And in the backdrop of seeming success like that, in the backdrop of, hey, you know, she lives by herself. She has her own vehicle. She's supporting herself. In the backdrop of that, I can't possibly be an alcoholic. My hair is too glossy. I'm wearing the right mascara. You know, I really just thought I had it together. But if you were to look in my house, you would be like, whoa, something's up. If you were to see the piles of mail I can't open, the messages I can't listen to, if you were to look inside my car and see like a bomb went off in it, like you would know something was up. The longer, you know, between 22 to 27, it was really hard for me to look right. It was really hard for me to front in this world because I couldn't do it. Superficially, that's what my life was looking like. Back here, I have 10 brothers and sisters who I'm pretending that don't exist because I'm the second oldest of 11 kids, and they're inconvenient. It's inconvenient to have to worry about what's going on with them. If there's electricity in the house, who's home? Who's watching them? Do they have food? Do they have clothes? Do they need help with their homework? Are they unprotected like I was unprotected? I can't think about that stuff because I've got stuff to do. I'm busy. I'm a tornado in my family's life because I have expectations of how everything should look. I derive prestige from my family, and if you're not getting the good grades and I can't brag about you, I don't want you in my life. You know, that's how selfish I am, and I can't even see it. I don't even know that I'm that way. So I'm isolated from my family. I am, there's a better word, estranged. I'm estranged from my family. but riddled with guilt, paralyzed with guilt, because I know that stuff is going on there, but I can't care about it because anything that came between me and my drink got gone. Because I can't care about you when I'm drinking. I can't care about myself. I'm the kind of alcoholic, I wake up in the morning, I gotta check my body. Because I don't know what happened last night. You know? Like, I have, like, bruises, you know, like, rug burn from here to here. That's not cute. Rug burn from here to here. You know, that you gotta explain that stuff. When I was working in a professional job, what's going on with your face? You know? It's hard to explain. There's no classiness in rug burn from here to here. Putting your teeth through your mouth. You know? At the end of my drinking, I cannot hide it anymore. You know, not to mention am I physically injuring myself and putting myself on blast? I'm crazy. People use the words like possessed, demonic. People have to do Reiki on me when I'm sleeping because when I am awake, I am angry. I am volatile. I am defensive. Who are you to tell me not to drink? Who are you? You don't know where I've been. I earn this. I have a job. You live in my house. You drive my car. I pay the bills. I did my relationships that way. So, you know, because I want, you don't tell me. You know, I like it that way. Go. There's another one. Let him in. You know, I like it that way. So... So, deterioration, right? Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Waking up in my own vomit. You know, waking up in a pool of my own vomit and not even being concerned that I may die that way, but mostly being concerned that that's not cool enough. It's not cool to die that way. You know, like, I don't want to die that way. That's embarrassing, you know? I need something like Blaze of Glory, Thelma and Louise, a car, convertible. I don't even have a friend to ride shotgun with me, but, you know? So, AA, you know? Because I have been given more love than I deserve. AA, I got led to AA because something out there loves me in spite of my self-destruction, in spite of all the self-destructive behavior, I don't know if anyone can relate, but my head is always like just a locomotive, always, always, always going, always reminding me, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? Don't forget who you are, where you've been, and what you've done. Don't forget that. And you know, I'm a real alcoholic. You take away my alcohol, and I am very sick. I have nothing in this world between me and you, and I have nothing in this world that makes me feel comfortable. I get very, very sick. And all of you guys can see me. And that terrifies me. Terrifies me. I'm going to talk about my experience with the steps. I went to these meetings, and I was just so ashamed of who I was, playing God in my own life. I needed to find a sponsor that had been places, had to have been somewhere, you know. And get a sponsor. I'm such a people pleaser. And then my friend that came in with me, she had already gotten a sponsor. I'm like, oh, should I get a sponsor? Oh my God, she's gonna be much more sober than me. She's already on the first step. Oh my God, I can't let her win. And so I'm like, who? I gotta find someone. And then there's this little older lady, and her clothing was probably like this size. She was like just barely wearing anything. And I was like, her. She can hear my fifth step. Because I'm already there. I'm in the fifth step where I have to tell someone where I've been, you know. And I met this woman, and she, you know, she didn't say yes immediately, which is not my, you know, it's not my jam. Like, people say yes to me, you know. And she's like, well, you need to call me. You need to call me for 10 days? My hours are from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Call me. 8:58 every night. I pay. Like, why should I? Well, she doesn't want to hear from me. What am I to say to her? What do you say to people? She doesn't want to hear from me. She's probably sleeping. She's old. She's probably tired already. You know? Well, she's not going to hear. So, hey, it's Cash calling in today. Checking a big guy. You know, like, 9, 10 days in a row, however many days I said, like, I did it every time. I couldn't even see myself. I couldn't even see, like, how unwilling I was, despite myself, you know. So she said yes. And, you know, the first step, admitted I was powerless over alcohol, not my life, was unmanageable. Like, I don't, some alcoholic life is my only normal one. I don't know any different. I don't know that people don't live the way that I live. I don't know that people don't check their bodies in the morning. I don't know that people don't, you know, like, just tuck that mail in a drawer somewhere, pretend like it's not there, or just get estranged from their family, or, you know, like, don't know the truth about themselves. You know, I don't know that. The unmanageability, what I realize now, I know unmanageability is not just external. It's not just that opening of the mail or the answering of my phone or, you know, like the actions that I do. Unmanageability is what the, it talks about on 52. It talks about that inability to live. You know, it talks about my separation from other human beings. I don't know how to human being, you know, I'm alone. I am full of fear and I don't even know it. I don't even know that fear has paralyzed me, and I'm so concerned with living comfortably in this world. It's all I can do. I can't show up because I need to feel comfortable. You know, I don't have the thing that makes me feel comfortable. I was looking for that, and I was trying to find it everywhere. You know, the second step, I have to go to it because I'm like, I can't recall them. Too nervous. So, the second step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I didn't know I was insane. That offended me, by the way, you know, because it kind of said, you know, it says that I'm insane. I don't appreciate that. And then, okay, so I'm wrestling with this idea of this power greater than me. Hey, where was that power greater than me when those things happened to me as a child? Where was the, you know, if God was here, I'm God's blind spot. Because he doesn't see me. You know, I really, really struggled with this idea. And like I said, the thing that kept me in the rooms is the fact that you guys could say the hard stuff. You guys could tell the truth about you and there was no fear. You guys could say the real shit and not be just not have any fear about it. And that was why I kept coming back, because something's going on here that I've never seen. I don't come from that. We don't talk about stuff like that. You don't talk about where your family's been or what's, you know, you just don't talk about it. And that was my power greater than me. You know, the third step, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. Even if you understand that you are God's blind spot, Catherine, that's okay. Even if you understand that he might have not have been looking, or he doesn't care about you during certain areas, or you're really not worth God's love. That's enough. However you want to do it. However inadequate, as the book says. Insufficient? However. And then this part of giving my will and my life, I was taught that that's my thoughts and my actions. How do I give my thoughts and my actions over to the care of God? You know, how do I think like God? How do I act like God? Well, I don't do any of that. I take the suggestions of my sponsor. You know, I run my shit past someone. And this is not something I did. This is not my first round of the steps. I'm telling you that I did all this. But I'm telling you, when I came into the program, giving my will and my life over to something else, it doesn't go hand in hand with survival. I don't know how to do that. I know how to survive. You know, and being like, oh, yeah, just not going to worry about it. That's not a survival technique that I learned. You know, and then giving my, what does this person know about me? What does this person know about survival? What does this person know about ensuring that I'm comfortable in this world? You know, and even though I didn't believe in it, I did it anyways. That first sponsor, that second sponsor, that third sponsor that I work with today, I run my shit past them, and I literally have called my sponsor. She's like, well, no, you're not going to do that because you can't punch people in the face in sobriety. So you're just going to go, and you're going to show up for your kids, and you're going to be happy, and you're going to smile. I was like, oh, I hate you. I hate you. She's like, I know you do. I just want you to know that, you know, this is not cool. You're going to do it anyways? Yeah. And I hang up the phone. I'm getting a new sponsor. I've probably broken up in my head with my sponsor like 4 or 5 times because she's just not nice. She's not nice. And you know what? I shut my mouth and I do what I'm told. And I don't have to cause a scene. Because that's what I was going to do. I like to cause a scene. You know, I like to let people know where I stand. And I shut my mouth, and I show it for my kids, and I don't have to cause a scene, and I get to stay sober another day. And I'm not talking about, like, putting a drink in my mouth, because let's face it, the longer we stay in these rooms, it's less and less about the liquid that we put in our mouth, but it's more about my alcoholic thinking. When I say I stay sober, I mean I don't get crazy. I don't do anything that I'm going to regret. I don't relapse on any bad behavior that's going to make me hate myself, that's going to make me have to take a drink. You know, because that's the thing that happens before I take a drink is I relapse on I hate myself. My piece of shitism is what I call it. You know, I relapse on that piece of shitism and then I have to drink because I'm so uncomfortable in this world. I hate myself, so of course all you two, you do too. The fourth step. I didn't have any trouble with this step. I love talking about myself. This was, I swear I did not. I was like, let's do this. And so I got to smoke, drink coffee, and tell my sponsor everything about me. And then came the part about where was I to blame. You know? Everything I have today is because of the fourth step. It's because I can take a look at where was I to blame. You know what? I'm resentful at people for stuff that I do. I am resentful, you know, when you look at that realization, me like them. Have you ever been, have you ever done that? Yeah. How have you done that to yourself and other, or to that person and other people? Ooh, yeah. You know? I never saw that. I never saw where I was to blame. I never saw that had I not started the ball rolling, that I wouldn't be in this predicament in the first place, you know? And that's super humbling. That is very, very humbling to take a look at how I move around this world. You know, how I put demands on everyone else. You be weller than me. I'm a sick one. Take care of me. You know? Be better. Oh, I don't want to be better, but you be better. You know, it's crazy. I couldn't see that. I could not see that. I did not know about that prayer. I did not know that there's a prayer in that step that will release that person. Because while I am resentful at that person, they're renting space in my head. They've got all the power. They're living up there, and I'm thinking, and I'm grinding away. I call it motherfucking. I'm motherfucking them, you know, motherfucking them all the way home. I drive home, you know, and they win, you know. Put it down on paper. Let it process. Tell someone else. Talk about it. Do that fifth step. Tell someone else. Hear the words come out of your mouth. Tell on yourself to your sponsor. I was really good at doing the fourth step, but not the fifth. Oh, that's my problem. I'm going to keep this to myself. Because then my sponsor's going to say, hey, didn't you have that problem last month? Oh, yeah, that's right. There's that. You know, I have to tell someone else because I need to be held accountable. I need to be held accountable because I'll reoffend. I will reoffend, and I have no qualms with that. You know, I'll dress it up into something different, and I'll reoffend. I need to be held accountable. I need to tell the truth about myself. The sixth step, we're entirely ready to God, to have God remove all these defects of character. I always like to say that my character defects are regular characteristics of just on like crack, just like, or steroids, you know, or, you know, just like really far this way or really far this way. And I don't know it. I'm not that smart. I can only know my character defects when you guys talk about your character defects. You guys are the best. You are the best help for me to tell me what my character defects are, because I'm not that smart, you know. It seems like the longer I stay sober, the more elusive those character defects become too. I can't see. I'll dress them up. I'll disguise them. You know. I get to the point sometimes where I can't even say. I can't see it, you know, and I'll ask myself, what am I afraid of? What's my fear? And I can't, it doesn't register. I have to ask myself, what's the worst thing that would happen? Oh, okay, I know what that means. You know, I have to ask myself that because they get hidden because they want to live. You know, I never, and what I realized too is that I'm not in charge of when they get to go. I don't like, oh, I'm done with that one now. No, I'm not in charge. God removes them. When God's ready, when the lesson's been learned, that's been my experience. When the lesson's been learned, I stop acting like a goddamn fool, you know, they'll be removed. Let my character defects show my sponsees how not to act. Let my character defects show my sponsees and anyone else who needs to see him how not to act. If that may be the case, you know, and then when the lesson's learned for whoever the lesson's for, then maybe it'll be removed. That's none of my business. I just try to do the next right indicated thing. Try to live right. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I had one person, maybe I'm not the only one with one person on their list. I had one person on my list that I was like, F that fool. Deserved it. Do it again. I can't live that way. And I'll tell you, it was my stepdad. He used to beat the shit out of me. And he'd beat the shit out of all of us. And he's one of us. And what happened when I was 17 years old, that stepdad went to prison for life. He had been in and out of prison throughout my whole story. But he had been in and out of prison, and finally he picked up 3 strikes, and he went to prison for life. And I was like, got sober, well, sorry, prison for life, can't go see him, rotten hell, you know, not my business. In the beginning, you know. And then what happened is God sent me to prison so that I could see what it's like for someone to spend that much time in prison, to see what it's like for a man with 11 kids to not see one of them, not have one of them visit, not have one of them write, not have one of them call. You know, I had no idea. And that's why I don't know what the lesson is. I don't know what the lesson's for me or the lesson's for him. You know, and I changed the way I felt. I changed the way I felt about him. And I was still like, well, he's in prison, so I can't really go see him because it's a conflict of interest. And then they paroled him. Damn it! You know, because God works that way. It's not my plan and design, like Pete was saying. You know, and I feel differently because guess what? I'm a parent now. I'm a parent, and it's terrifying. I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but it's hard to be a parent. And guess what? I raised my children like I was raised, and I've been heavy-handed. And I have felt, I love my kids. I love them. And I have been heavy-handed. I can only imagine what it was like. Could it be that he loved me too? But he raised me like he was raised. Could it be that? You know, my heart cracked open for this man. When I made that realization, when I worked the steps to make that realization, could he be like me? I'm different now. I didn't come to the rooms for this. I didn't come to the rooms to feel differently about this man, and here I am. I didn't want to get sober to feel differently about this man, and here I am. You know, it's absolutely amazing. You know, and that's not the first person in my family that I felt that way about. And that's not the first time I've had a different reaction to the people in my family as a result of looking at who I am and where I've been and what I've done. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Was doing that earlier in the bathroom. You know, I mean, this is a daily thing. I'm not perfect, you know, and fear flares up those character defects. Fear makes me act out. I'm really concerned with how I look. I'm really concerned with being comfortable in this world. And then I draw back. Help me. Help me. Help me be as you would have me be. Please remove my fear and direct my thinking. Give me the right thought and action, because I don't know. I'm not afraid to say I don't know. I'm afraid. I'm not afraid to say it to people, you know, here in these rooms or out in the world. You know, I don't have all the right answers. Made it direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Wasn't really. I thought I owed amends to everyone. I felt so worthless. When I got here, that I just assumed I owed everyone an amends. I was wrong. I just was, as a human being, fundamentally as a human being, I was wrong. So I just assumed I owed everyone an amends. You know, and I started to chip away at those amends, and I started, you know, this stuff's about justice. You know, I started to make peace in this world with the people. But I could not do that unless I had worked thorough steps prior. Because, like with my mom, I'll give you that example. That woman that, you know, that she was to blame for every bad thing that happened in my life. I got 5 minutes. I reoffended, made amends, reoffended. You know, I had to act right, continually act right with her. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Inventory, all the time. Whenever I am uncomfortable, I have to take a look at it. That's spiritual axiom that the 12 and 12 talks about. When you spot it, you got it. Someone in a meeting earlier today was talking about it. I don't have the luxury of sitting on stuff like that. I don't have the luxury of being like, meh, oh well. You know, because I do stupid shit over stuff like that. And then I get embarrassed, and then I can't show my face in certain places, and then I'm isolating, and then I get really thirsty. You know, I have to do this. I have to take a look at myself. I have to tell my sponsor who I am and where I've been today. You know, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. I love this step. There's a long period of reconstruction ahead. Is that what it says? You know, I am a work in progress. So ask my wife, who's in the program as well, what it's like to live with me. Ask my sponsees what it's like to be, you know, like I can still be that tornado. I can still have very, very high expectations, you know, of myself and you. Don't shake your head, Mireya. I see you.
on this program.
I gotta take a look at myself, you know, and I have 3 minutes and I need to talk about step 12. I need to talk about step 12. I don't have the luxury of coming sitting down at the table and eating. I best be cooking the food. I best be setting the table. I best be serving and washing the dishes. I've been restored. I'm better than when I walked in here. My life is amazing. I better be giving back. I better have a message, and I better share it. And I better go out there and talk to the face that I don't know. Because I cannot stay this way unless I give it away. And I am unafraid. I'm unafraid to do that. And I encourage the women to be, the women I sponsor, all of you, to be unafraid. Because Pete was in some of the first meetings I ever went to. Thank you. Because the door was open for me. And I am ensuring that the message is being shared so that the door is open for other people in this program, for your kids and for your grandkids and my kids' kids. I've seen people in the rooms slip away. Time under your belt, alcoholism doesn't care. I encourage you to get into sponsorship. I encourage you to share your story with someone else. It has only been since I have been working with the women that I work with today that I have been able to see myself. I forget. I've only been doing this for 10 years, and I forget where I've been. And the women in my life, the women that I work with, remind me. Because just like I can't remember the pain and suffering of a week or a month ago with my drinking, I can't remember the pain and suffering of that inventory I did about my mom. And I will reoffend. I can't remember who I've been as a wife. I have to work with another alcoholic so they can remind me that I still need this program. So it terrifies me to see people with time unsponsored. It terrifies me to see people with time not sponsoring and keeping and coveting what they have as if it was theirs to keep. That terrifies me. It's your choice, you know. It's not my story. I have to give it away to keep it. If you are not sponsoring, please do that. Share the message. I'm gonna finish with this. Amy A, Mary G, Jamie M, Marlene, and Teresa. These are women that I sat in the rooms with that aren't here anymore. Because they could not do this. And they were not exempt, just like I'm not exempt. And I will not let them be forgotten. I was at a speaker meeting the other day that says, it's only when we stop saying their names that they're forgotten. And I will not forget them. and I will do what I'm told by my sponsor and about the people who walked before me so that they are honored. Thank you.